Time to get started. Welcome to Sunstone 2011 here in Ogden, Utah. Should be in room 321. It's time to begin our session entitled The Hollow World of Cyrus Teague. Our presenter is Stephen L. Richardson. He has worked in geology, cartography, engineering. For the past few years, he's been perfecting the technology for 3D anaglyphic maps with his son, Ben. Forgot to tell you, I'm Jake Zollinger, the chair for the session. Occasionally in Sunstone, along with all the repetitive themes we have something new and unusual and fun, and this promises to be one of those. Before we start, I remind you, please, to quiet your cell phones and show proof, if need be, of your having purchased a ticket. Our presenter will take approximately 40, 45 minutes, and then he'll allow questions. This is an hour session. So, will you please speak loudly? We do not have traditional mics like we've had at the Sheraton Hotel. This is a recorder, and it's supposed to be sensitive, but when you ask a question, you might want to stand up and speak loudly.
Do you want me to shut the door? I'll get it.
Hi, it's good to see you all. Shouldn't have done that. I won't go into that. To start with, I wanted to show you something that you might find interesting, just so that you all know we're on the same page about what these people believe. And so here we go. I'm supposed to do this, and then this, and then this. There's a guy named Alan Andrews. He was a member of this group from the very beginning in New York. And here's his explanation of their beliefs.
In the winter 1896 and 97, the geodetic staff of the Correction Unity of Estero, Florida, conducted a survey on the Gulf Shore at Naples, Florida. This survey covered a period of several months, demonstrating conclusively that the Earth curves upward and that we are living on the inner surface of a hollow globe, sun, moon, and stars all being within the circumference of 25,000 miles. We have here a working model of the hollow globe, or cellular cosmogony, as we call it. Here on the inner surface of the Great Shell, you will see the Western Hemisphere, and over here is the Eastern Hemisphere. Here is the sphere of the heavens revolving with sun, moon, and stars. Contrary to the usual belief that China is beneath our feet, it is in reality above us.
So, that's your introduction. Actually, that's kind of an abstract to the whole paper right there. But here we go. Let's see. Yeah. At about 7 a.m. on the 28th of June, 1951, when the bus arrived from Denver, a man named Moses Weaver stepped off and onto the streets of Ogden, Utah. He had no luggage, $3 in his pocket, and he knew no one. By mistake, he thought he had arrived in Salt Lake City, where he also knew no one, and would have also only had $3. He was nearing the end of a very long spiritual journey, and now he was here in Ogden. His $3 wouldn't last long. He arranged for a room at the Salvation Army, and they also paid for his dinner. I should have done that. Thank you. That's him. They also paid for his dinner at a local restaurant. The following Monday, he applied for a job but was refused work because of his age. He was 87 years old. By trade, Moses was a sign painter, an artist, and a poet. He spent the $3 on sign painting materials. He painted a sign in the window of the Kingdom Hall of the Jehovah's Witnesses for free, and after having done that, he had no shortage of friends among the Witnesses of Ogden. For the next 7 months, he lived in a hotel, earning a good reputation for the artistry he put into his work. He became aware that Ogden is a religious city with over 60% of its inhabitants being members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He also learned that they had 31 wards led by an Aaronic and a Melchizedek priesthood, which he interpreted as a professional clergy. He had no interest in priestcraft. By September, he had run out of places to paint signs, so he printed a pamphlet of his poetry and began selling copies of it door to door. A lady named Mary Nielsen bought some of his poems and asked him to sit and listen to General Conference on her radio. He was very impressed by what he heard. He later met other Mormons. One gave him a book containing radio speeches by LDS Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith. A lady named Charlotte Stevens gave him a Book of Mormon and invited him to church. He was baptized into the LDS Church in December 1951 at the age of 88. Prior to becoming a Mormon, he was one of the last of the Koreshans, an interesting religious group who had very unusual ideas about the way that the world is constructed. Equally interesting is the fact that he was a communist, as were all Koreshans. Without difficulty, he brought both of these beliefs intact into Mormonism. With this paper, I intend to present a brief history of the Koreshan unity movement led by a prophet named Cyrus Reed Teed. Though it was a very small religious group, and it had no relationship to the Branch Davidians or to the Mormons, and today it's extinct. It had some very spectacular features in both its theology and in its concept of community. It was a utopian socialist commune that lasted for more than 60 years. Cyrus Teed was born in October 1839 in Moravia, Delaware County, New York. He was the second of eight children. Shortly after he was born, the family moved to a place near Utica, New York. At the age of 11, Cyrus left school and worked on the towpath for the Erie Canal. His family wanted him to become a Baptist minister, but he chose instead the field of medicine. Cyrus began his medical studies with his uncle in Utica in 1859. That same year, he married a distant cousin, Celia M. Rowe. A son named Douglas Arthur Teed was born the next year. The Teeds moved to New York City in 1862, and in August of that year, at the age of 24, Cyrus joined the 127th New York Infantry, mustering in as a corporal. He served for 15 months, mostly in South Carolina. He then attended the Eclectic Medical College of New York City and graduated in 1868. Eclectic doctors were similar to the herbal and naturopathic doctors of today. He began his practice of medicine at Deerfield, which is near Utica. And in his spare time, he experimented with alchemy. It was his belief that energy and matter are two forms of the same substance. He began experiments which he hoped would lead to the ability to change matter into energy and energy back into matter. He was working late one night in the autumn of 1869, and he claims that he succeeded in doing exactly that, as well as another alchemist's goal, as he transformed lead into microscopic particles of gold that precipitated to the bottom of his flask. That same night, very soon after his discovery, he felt that God the Father would soon make an appearance to him, and he fell into a trance in which he lost all consciousness of having a physical body. He heard sweet, soft music and then saw 12 jewels which eventually graced the crown on the head of a lovely woman, the Divine Motherhood, clad in a robe of purple and gold. She told Cyrus that he had been chosen to redeem the human race and that although his struggle in doing this would be difficult, she would assist him by again assuming mortal form. She told him that he would have 3 weeks of years to do this work. That translates out to 21, I think. Teed returned to his home and slept for 2 hours. Twice that night he heard the sound of a hurricane and the noise of chariot wheels. When silence returned, he began to hear delicate rhythmic murmurings, which gradually unfolded to him the mysteries of immortal life. He took the name Koresh, which is the Hebrew pronunciation of the personal name Cyrus, a person described prophetically in the Bible, and it's also his own first name. His father was Jesse Teed, so he took special interest in the following verse from the Bible, Isaiah 11:10. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, to to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And he also liked this one, Isaiah 44:28. Thus saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, for and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. He immediately told anyone who would listen of his encounter with God, and many of his medical patients were uneasy and found another doctor. But a few believed what he had to say, including Alan Andrews, by the way. However, not enough stayed for him to continue his medical practice, and so he became estranged from his wife, and he's ridiculed by the public. He moved from town to town within New York. He only had a few followers in the 1870s, and he spent some time among various community societies, including the Shakers and the Harmonists in New York and Pennsylvania. Times were hard, but his illumination continued with inspiring ideas, not of just how the world is, but the way society should be. They didn't all come at once, but when they arrived, they were laden with elegant details. In 1886, he was invited to speak to a convention of the National Association of Mental Science in Chicago. His subject was the brain. Quote, taking up a Bible, Dr. Teed held it out in full view of the audience. He said, this book is sometimes called the Word of God, but nowhere in the book itself is it stated that it is God's Word, unquote. He then explained that there is but one God's Word, and that is God himself. He added, the Bible is the greatest scientific work that there is. He showed a chart, looked like that one. Did I mention that? Sorry, I got lost. Okay, so he was looking at the chart. that's a chart that they later published, and so it's probably the same one. Let me see. Okay. He then held up a chart. Okay. He went into great detail on how the brain works and how knowledge of it can be applied to restore individuals that are invalid to health. He explained that religion and science must be married, and the result will be the wedding of heaven and earth. Immediately after his talk, he healed an invalid woman, and she was able to walk. Teed was so well received that he was elected president of the organization. His reception in Chicago was much friendlier than he'd ever gotten in New York, and so he stayed there. A church was organized called the Assembly of the Covenant, or the Church Triumphant, and a school was begun called the World's College of Life. In 1887, the society Arch Triumphant was organized, and Mrs. Annie G. Ordway became the president. She was given the name Victoria Gratia, and she was believed to be the embodiment of the Divine Motherhood from Teed's vision. The majority of the converts seemed to be middle-class, well-educated women. There was a printing office where Teed's long-running publication, The Guiding Star, later renamed The Flaming Sword, was published, in addition to numerous pamphlets. Dr. Teed was a powerful and an influential speaker, as well as being a persuasive writer. The people in his audiences were painfully aware of the problems living in this world can bring. In those days, there was no such thing as Social Security or Medicare, no such thing as health insurance. Pay was low, work hours were long, there were no requirements for protection of workers from workplace hazards, no provision for the sick, for sick leave or vacations. Lives of the poor were short and filled with fear for what the future would bring next. There was no shortage of ills in the world that could kill you and leave you a helpless cripple. In the meantime, the wealthy paid no taxes. They had every opportunity to increase their wealth, and they controlled the government even more than they do today. Koresh offered a world configured in the way that God must have meant it to be, and nearly every claim he made could be supported from the Bible, which he, like his audience, considered to be without errors. He and his followers could find support for nearly all of their theology in the Bible. The entire creation story in Genesis makes perfect sense from a creation standpoint if you assume that the firmament in the King James Bible is referring to a dome, as in other versions. The image that I get is kind of like we're on the inside of a big bubble. And it's really big. It's so big you can't see, you know, which way the ground goes. throughout the Bible, the writers appear to have had that same view of the world. Teed's teachings pioneered in the concept of women's rights and women's liberation. Many women left their husbands to join the group, leaving behind obviously unhappy husbands. There were a number of lawsuits against Teed. In 1892, Sidney Miller filed suit against Teed for alienation of infection. He claimed that Dr. Teed had convinced his wife to believe, quote, that a woman's body was her own, that marriage and sex and sexual love should be abandoned, and that she should leave her husband and join the Christian community, unquote. Other lawsuits from other husbands followed, but though they were bothersome, they were generally unsuccessful. The Koreshans distributed their literature and held meetings on Chicago street corners. And, you know, this hollow world thing was sort of attractive to a lot of people because they wanted to at least understand it or maybe argue with it. There was a rumor. Oh, okay, well, these events led... I guess I should push. Yes, okay, there we go. That's a political cartoon. These events led to newspapers becoming very anti-Koreshan, and members of the group were persecuted physically and verbally. There was a rumor that Koresh would soon be lynched. The group relocated to an isolated communal home in the Chicago suburbs, which was called Beth Orphra, which is Hebrew for the House of Dust. By 1891, the church had a membership of about 110. About 86 of them were women. Teed, in the meantime, traveled around the country. This was like a flyer that they would pass out just to get people to come to hear the speeches. He traveled around the country speaking on Koreshanity. He explained that Koreshanity grew out of Christianity, the same way that Christianity grew out of Judaism, and that he was a seventh Messiah that God had sent to redeem the world. The six messengers who preceded him were Adam, Enoch, Noah, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. Teed was a man, but he established the planetary court. Five intelligent women. Each one of them was named after one of the astrological planets to manage and govern the spiritual and economic affairs of the community. In the minds of the men and women of the Unity, such a lofty name for the court connected it and its functions to the universe. Just as for the Mormons, the symbols of earth, moon, sun, and stars on the Salt Lake Temple connected to God's creations. In Teed's theology, one finds elements not only from alchemy and astrology, but from Greek and Egyptian mythology as well, in addition to the Bible. The Koreshans practice celibacy. When you take sex out of the equation, men and women really are equal. They campaign for the rights of women to vote from the very beginning. The neighbors supposed that the Koreshans were a secret free love community. In actuality, the men and women of the Unity were the exact opposite. Evidence of this is Koreshan dances, where the men would dance with men and the women with women. Men and women in the Unity could marry and have children, but they could only have sex if they deliberately intended to have a child as a result. Another class of Koreshan belonged to the Unity purely for the opportunities for work and education. There was no requirement that they accept the religious teachings of Koresh. So, as persecutions in Chicago intensified, Dr. Teed was inspired to lead them to a place in the wilderness far from their former home. On one of his speaking trips, he heard about some land for sale at Pine Island on the west coast of Florida. In December 1893, he went there accompanied by several of the leading Koreshans, but discovered that the price for the land was $150,000, which was more than they could afford. As they left to return to Chicago, Teed left some literature behind at the telegraph office, which was discovered and read by Gustav Domkohler, a German immigrant who wrote to Teed offering to sell his properties near Estero, Florida, 18 miles south of Fort Myers. The group returned to Florida. That's the property. That's the river part. There's also land. The group returned to Florida and arranged to buy the property, and Koreshans came to southern Florida by the trainload. The prophet told them that they were building a new Jerusalem. Dr. Teed described their future home, quote, "It will contain 10 million people, white and black, and will become the greatest city in the world," unquote. In the center of the city would be a domed temple surrounded by a circular pond of water, and he gave a very detailed description of the temple and of the ultra-modern city which would surround it. Looking around at their beautiful surroundings, how could they believe otherwise? This was the genius of Dr. Teed. He not only had a dream for a better world, but also a detailed plan on how to make it happen. The Qureshians were very productive. They quickly established a state-of-the-art printing plant, an electrical generating plant, a sculpture and concrete works, tin works, a machine shop, shops that made mattresses, hats, baskets, shoes, as well as a laundry, dining hall, sawmill, and a boat factory. They had extensive farms as well as extensive farms that raised all kinds of crops and animals. They had a modern school and a college with adult education programs. They built the core of the city and enjoyed a utopian level of technology unheard of in that region. And there they lived a happy life, dealing with each other in peace, far from the persecutions they had once endured. There were many believers in many countries that never immigrated. There were about 4,000 believers in Qureshianity in the United States. Most of them didn't go. The entire population at the site eventually tapered off at about 250. But those who had made the effort to go there lived in a golden age. They had no need for money. All their needs were provided. They had no worries about their health. A doctor and a dentist provided what they needed at no cost. They were promised that when they got old or incapacitated, that the unity would continue to take care of them. Education, music, and entertainment were provided several times a week without charge, and there were elaborate productions too, with scenery, as you can see, and costumes. One wonders why there were not more converts to Qureshianity. The celibacy thing, that might be a part of the problem. But despite the advanced social attitudes of this group, it's likely that the Qureshian theology was just too much of a radical change from what people were accustomed to. It was like bringing your Mormon great-grandparents to the Sunstone Conference. Even among Latter-day Saints, converts are attracted more by our belief in the Bible, in Jesus Christ, and strong families than they were by our historic beliefs in polygamy and excluding blacks from the priesthood. The idea that the Earth is hollow is not new. Edmund Halley, the astronomer who discovered Halley's Comet, wrote about it in 1692. Among other factors, the idea was based on the Aurora Borealis, also known as the Northern Lights, which could be seen at night from the far northern latitudes and sometimes all over Europe. Halley thought that the phenomenon was caused by gases escaping from openings near the poles and possibly lit by an internal sun. This provided an incentive for a succession of explorers who sailed north to find where the gases were coming from. Frequently, they never returned, which was proof that they must have gone someplace. 23. Jules Verne published his science fiction novel, A Journey to the Center of the Earth, in French in 1864, but it didn't appear in English until 1870. About this time, a popular idea appeared among Mormons that the Lost Ten Tribes are waiting inside the earth, and when they return, it will be from the North Countries. It persists even today. Beginning in 1870, Dr. Teed discovered that the earth is hollow, but we're on the inside of it. The idea is called cellular cosmogony. He taught that there are seven metallic layers forming the outer shell of the Earth's sphere. Gold is the outside layer, followed by silver, copper, zinc, iron, tin, and lead. This is the metallic shell and is 15 miles thick. Above these are five mineral strata and then five geologic strata. The shell of the Earth is 100 miles thick. Above the surface of the Earth are three atmospheres. Above the surface of the Earth are three atmospheres. Closest to us is our atmosphere. Did I need 27? I don't know. Let's look. Ah, yes. Okay. There's three atmospheres. The closest to us is our atmosphere of nitrogen and oxygen. That's the stuff we breathe. Above that was hydrogen, and above that there was a sphere of a gas called by T. He called it aboron, and I don't know what that means. It might be an alchemist term. In the center of the Earth, 4,000 miles away, is a source of the sun's light, which is never seen directly. When we see the sun come over the horizon in the morning, we are seeing the projected image that has been refracted, diffracted, and distorted, so that it only appears to come over the horizon. The moon, planets, and stars were believed to be distorted images and refractions as well, and they were thought to move around by electromagnetic impulses. There's fuzzy areas in the sky known as nebula. They were thought to be stars that were projected out of focus. Comets were lenticular refractions and reflections of solar energies moving in a spiral orbit around the sun. They were composed of either a crystallic lens or a lens of a crystallic energy. They were... If you've ever been to a planetarium show, that's pretty close to what the Christians believe that was taking place in the sky, but on a much larger scale and with a much more complicated projection system. And what's outside the hollow Earth? Nothing. Or if there is something, it's nothing you need to be concerned about. For the Koreshans, the end result was that God created an Earth containing its own universe, and it was cleverly designed to appear as though it was a natural occurrence. At first a skeptic, one of the converts was a geodesist named Ulysses Grant Morrow. He was named after Ulysses Grant, the general, obviously. Geodesists are scientists who specialize in measuring the Earth, and so he was well suited for what came next. His first tests were along a canal near Chicago and later on the shores of Lake Michigan, but the results were inconclusive. Because Koresh taught that light is bent by gravity, air density, convection currents, and other factors, and seldom, if ever, travels in a straight line, Morrow had to come up with a way of measuring the curvature of the Earth's surface mechanically without depending on light. He eventually invented a simple survey instrument made out of brass and seasoned mahogany and had it constructed by the Pullman Railway Coachworks. It was based on a drafting instrument called a T-square. Shaped like a T, these allow draftsmen to draw one line at a right angle to other lines and also parallel and do things like that. Morrow built at least four of these. Each of them were 12 feet long and 4 feet high, with the end of each was forming a T. They were designed to be clamped together and project a straight line down their length. There were at least four of these constructed, and many more support structures were built. The part that we're talking about is actually just this T part. Okay, this support structure isn't there yet. Here's the theory. If the Earth's surface is convex, the line would get farther from the surface with distance, and if it's concave, the line would get closer. And this is a bunch of those structures that are... doing what they're supposed to do, projecting a straight line. So, in the 1896 and 1897, the beach at Naples, Florida, which is south of Fort Myers, was selected for the survey because it had no obstructions. Morrow, delighted in having Koreshan and non-Koreshan visitors come to see the progress, and also he liked to explain the geodetic process to them. The beginning element was leveled once, and then the distance of 128 inches above sea level was measured. There was no further leveling done as the survey continued down the beach. To eliminate residual errors, an element would be rotated 180 degrees after removal from one end and before it was attached to the other end of the device. This is a view sighting down the structure. Visually, it is aligned perfectly with the horizon. Teed taught that light doesn't travel in a straight line, which is why the survey had to be done mechanically. A side view about halfway through the survey shows that the line is no longer parallel to the horizon represented by the water in the background. At a distance of a little over 4 miles, after the T elements had been connected together for more than 1,800 times as shown in the second column of this table, The line had projected from 128 inches to sea level. And this shows to Morrow's satisfaction that the world curves upward instead of downward, with a circumference of 25,000 miles. No similar survey has been done since then. However, in 1901, a careful measurement was made by Dr. Fred McNair of the Michigan School of Mines between plumb lines in three mine shafts over 4,000 feet deep at the Tamarack Mine in Utah. Tamarack Mine in Michigan, connected by a 3,200-foot tunnel. The lines were further apart at the top than at the bottom of the shafts. Dr. McNair couldn't explain why, but the Koreshans took it as proof that the Earth's surface is concave. The Koreshans had certain other proofs. But they felt anyone with an open mind could easily discover the facts for themselves. There were reports that people who ascended in balloons observed that the Earth below appeared to stretch out below them as though they were flying above a giant bowl. Although the hulls of distant ships appear to disappear below the horizons because of what we interpret as curvature as shown on the top, the Koreshans claimed that the hulls would still be visible if you looked through a telescope at them. There were many stories of objects being visible across a lake or a bay that should have been out of sight if the Earth's surface is really convex. The geographic teachings of the prophet were so complicated that few, if any, of his followers understood how it all worked. However, that's also the nature of the world we inhabit. Outsiders could join the community, even if there were teachings of the prophet they couldn't accept. The geographic truth had been revealed by God to a prophet, and the basic concept had been proven by a careful geodetic survey. The rest of the details would fall into place as the sciences advanced. For the meantime, Dr. Teed's followers lived in a paradise with good jobs, good homes, good friends, good food, beautiful gardens in which to stroll, numerous academic and cultural events. They lived among intelligent and friendly people who could be trusted. Who wouldn't want to live in such a place? This is the world in which they lived. Like the Book of Mormon, Koresh's hollow world concept attracted attention from everyone who heard of it. Those who believed it studied the evidence, and like the Book of Mormon, most people had no way of proving it wrong. Koresh's teachings concerning a hollow earth relied on the idea that light can be bent by gravity, though science considered the idea to be absolutely stupid at the time. It was claimed to be a fact by Albert Einstein in 1916 and proven during a solar eclipse expedition in 1919. There are at least 12 places in the sky where we find objects called gravitational lenses that bend light in such a way as to provide us with distortions or multiple images of far distant objects. Light is refracted by Earth's gravity as well, but probably not as much as Chris taught that it is. Dr. Teed was a great thinker, a powerful motivator, and a likable and approachable guy. Good fisherman, too. He frequently took groups of his followers on hunting and fishing trips through Florida in the forests and the rivers. Undoubtedly, he believed in the vision or illumination that started his movement. The practical things, he said, made common sense, and at the time the mysteries he presented were plausible, and his followers thrilled to the understanding he gave them of the workings of God's universe. This is a diagram of the Koreshan Unity's organization. It's kind of like a totem pole a business would do. Teed taught that cellular cosmogony was the cornerstone on which Koreshanity was founded, and the same design that applied to astronomy also applied as well to theology, sociology, and geometry. In reality, common sense was the cornerstone. The Koreshans could rally behind the causes of socialism, of women's rights, of education, of racial equality, of political activism, because those causes were positive steps from a backward and oppressive society. The Unity had extensive gardens and an ex- advanced knowledge of horticulture. The Koreshan Gardens became kind of a plant zoo with plants from all over the world where they actually brought them and they actually figured out ways to make them grow. This is a picture of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford. They had winter homes in Fort Myers, and they would come down to visit, not just because they wanted to see how these advanced Koreshans functioned as a society, but also to get ideas on growing their own tropical gardens, because they were looking at different types of materials for their inventions. While the prophet and his followers enjoyed a life of comparative comfort, it led to an uneasy coexistence with their neighbors in Fort Myers and neighboring towns, whose lives were less fulfilling and more primitive. Most of them were farmers without much education. They were concerned about the political power the group had demonstrated in a recent election. They also had to buy electricity from the Koreshans. These neighbors made irreverent fun of the group's odd beliefs and concerning marriage, as well as the geographic truths that they held sacred. There came a day in 1906 that the prophet and some of his followers ventured into a neighboring town to transact some business. Over a misunderstanding, they found themselves in a street fight, and Koresh was severely injured. His health declined, and 2 years later, he died. This brought a dilemma to the community because the prophet had not appointed anyone to take charge when he was no longer there. In fact, he had said God told him that if he died, he would be resurrected or reincarnated. This was a real fuzzy doctrine for them because they're supposed to mean the same thing. And returned to his followers with even more teachings from God. What should they do? The local authorities eventually required the followers to bury him, and with much sorrow, the prophet's body was placed in an impressive cement tomb designed to resemble the Ark of the Covenant. A marble stone was part of it, engraved with the simple words, "Cyrus, Shepherd, Stone of Israel." His followers were divided on what would happen next. Some thought he was dead and that was the end of it. Some thought he would resurrect or reincarnate, and that his body in the tomb was being prepared for that event. And some thought that he'd been just mistaken when he assumed the role of a Messiah. Well, in 1921, a hurricane came to South Florida, Southwest Florida, and when it was subsided, the tomb was gone and was never seen again. Dr. Teed had been much more flexible in accommodating scientific discoveries into his cosmogony than the Koreshan leaders, who were now on their own. They believed that science had a conspiracy against them, or at least that scientists were not looking honestly at the facts that they considered to be truths. Astronomy prior to World War I was an activity engaged in mostly by wealthy hobbyists. Some of the telescopes were large, but the optics and the mounts were not yet perfected, and photographic plates were not very sensitive. There were many objects in the sky that would not be understood for decades, and there's still a lot of them up there that we don't know anything about. Public interest in astronomy intensified beginning in 1894 with the announcement by American astronomer Percival Lowell of the discovery of canals on Mars. The young people of the Unity... The young people of the Unity had parents, but all members of the community had a part in raising them. In 1910, as the return of Halley's Comet approached, the general public became more educated about what astronomy is all about. The young Koreshans were bewildered by articles in the outside press. To counteract it, the Flaming Sword introduced a feature called For the Younger Minds, devoted to the youth, explaining the Koreshan cosmogony and encouraging the young people to write letters to Washington to call on the Coastal Geodetic Survey, to perform its own survey to determine if the Earth's surface is concave or convex. That was an important issue to them. By the 1930s, there were only about 36 elderly Koreshans. Most of their young people had gone elsewhere and had found new things to believe in. The Koreshans' workplaces were idle because they were outdated and had been poorly managed since the death of Koresh. Because the Unity was a true communist society, those who remained were the owners of the hundreds of acres of Koreshan properties. It's probable that many of them never left because they actually had invested everything they had in the commune and had nowhere else to go. During that time, Koresh had a following in Europe, especially in Germany. In the 1930s, a disabled German aviator named Peter Bender revived interest in the Hollow Earth idea. These are books written by some of his followers. One of them, Rudolf Nibel, believed that it would be possible to launch a rocket through the Earth and have it splash into the ocean near New Zealand. He convinced the German city of Magdeburg to finance construction of a rocket about 25 feet tall. It flew several times in 1933, returning to the Earth each time by parachute. Its farthest trip was less than a mile before the Nazi government prohibited any further civilian rocket experiments. Peter Bender later became the headmaster at a Jewish school at Frankfurt am Main. He hoped to join the Koreshans at Estero, but he and his wife died in a concentration camp. However, one of the teachers at his school, Hedwig Mikael, made it to America and joined the Koreshan Unity in 1940, and it was she who brought the store and the service station back to life, established a restaurant and a trailer park. Using her business skills, she restored the Unity from poverty to sustainability. By 1961, there were only four of the original Koreshans living at the site. Hedwig worked a deal with the Florida State Parks to transfer ownership of the properties to the state of Florida if it would provide for the remaining Koreshans, allowing them to live in their homes until they passed away, and maintain the property and buildings as a historic site. And an important part of the deal was the extensive Koreshan historical archives, much of which are now available online. To make them easy to get to, I've provided a link, or a bunch of links that would take you to the most important things. And it's at a website that I've created. It's called koreshan.homestead.com. The last of the original Koreshans was Lillian Newcomb, who lived in this house until she died in 1974. When asked whether she really believed that we live on the inside of the Earth, she said, "I did until the boys landed on the moon. When that happened, I knew it couldn't be true." Hedwig continued to defend... I got sad for a second, sorry. Hedwig continued to defend the doctrines of Dr. T to anyone who would listen. Here she is speaking to a class from a local college at her 90th birthday party. Someone referred to her as the last Koreshan. She replied, "There is no last, we shall continue." She died in 1982 and is buried in her garden in the Koreshan State Park. We should now return to the story of Moses Weaver, who joined the LDS Church in Ogden in 1951. He was born in Lancaster. Stay here for a while. He was born in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania in 1863. His family raised him as a Stauffer Mennonite, a group that rejected modern improvements and enjoyment of pleasures and luxuries. Led by a bishop, they were allowed no jewelry, no false teeth, no pictures on the wall or photographs of themselves, no wallpaper, nothing ornamental or colorful, no music of any kind, no games or amusements. They were taught, the rougher the cross, the brighter the crown. Moses' grandmother was excommunicated when it was discovered that she had made a small cushion for her chair. Because of this infraction, her family was forbidden from associating with her. Moses found it difficult to fit in with the rest of his family. He enjoyed music. He enjoyed works of art. He enjoyed drawing pictures and modeling in clay. Despite all the religious training that he had had, that these things were evil, he wrote that at the age of 8, quote, "The thought of going insane tormented me more and more until at length it seemed as if I could stand it no longer. Then I sought relief by going out to the barn and cried out by myself. I was sure I was alone, yet I heard a voice. The voice said, 'Moses, you are not going insane. You'll be a great man one day.' 'Will I become president?' 'Greater than that,' the voice replied. 'Greater than the president.'" This was spoken in a lovely tone and so clearly pronounced that I knew it came from heaven, unquote. He was guided by this voice several more times as his life progressed. He married Ada Ilgenfritz in 1887, and within 3 years they had a one-acre farm in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But by 1900, the couple decided they were unable to have children. After several years in the Koreshian unity, Moses and Ada decided in 1900 to move to Estero, Florida, where all of the members worked, ate, and lived together as one large family. He worked at multiple jobs in the unity, but when the printing office discovered his artistic talents, he became their full-time artist. He says, "I drew plans for our buildings, designed the walks, steps, and flower beds for the gardens, and I made ornamental urns and vases of concrete, modeling in clay. I made some portrait busts of members, also a lion, an eagle, and other figures." This is a picture of some things that he undoubtedly was involved in making. Also, I painted signs, banners, and the stage scenery for our plays. And I staged outdoor pageants for our festivals. This is one of their pageants. Moses' wife, Ada, left him within 6 months. Sorry, I'm too far ahead of myself. Okay, within 6 months after Dr. Teed had died, about two-thirds of the Koreshians had left the unity. The property remained in the ownership of the shrinking members. Who shrinking numbers of members who had stayed in Estero. Weaver had to make a living, and so he went to Tampa, Florida, and he found work repairing and selling Singer sewing machines. He remembered Tacy Evelyn Hayworth, who was one of the sisters of the unity, who had gone to Kansas. He wrote to her, and she came to Florida, and they were married in 1911. The couple went through good times and bad and moved to various places around Florida, including a return to the unity in Florida at Estero in 1938. There he did some retouching on artworks that he had done before. Then he was assigned to work on the sugarcane field. He wrote, "I found their former friendly cooperation had disappeared, and all were subject to those dictators who called themselves the Board of Management." He was a true communist. He went to Fort Myers to work painting signs, and then on to St. Petersburg. In his leisure time, he did a painting of the New Jerusalem for the unity at Estero, and that's shown here. Tacy died in 1942, and concerned for his own salvation, Moses went to hear a lady evangelist who preached repentance and baptism. He determined that he would find a man endowed with power and authority from on high. Someone told him that if he went to Denver, Colorado, he, quote, would find someone. I find baptizing is being done there by a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, and newborn sons of God may be seen walking the streets of Denver doing their work, that they were spirits of the just who came up from the dead and were born again in the bodies of those who had been cleansed by the waters of baptism, and each received the Holy Ghost according to promise, that this work in Denver is the beginning of the resurrection of the just foretold by prophecy, unquote. Though this doctrine was contrary to his understanding of Scripture, he went to Denver looking for the high priest, only to be disappointed. He soon found employment in Denver painting signs, but one day a sudden feeling struck him that he must get away from Denver. He went to the bus station, and before he knew it, he'd bought a ticket to Salt Lake City on a bus that left in 8 minutes. He had no time to even go back and get his belongings. As described in the beginning, he ended up in Ogden and was eventually baptized a member of the LDS Church. He wrote, "Having passed through the pains of my new birth of water and of the Spirit, I opened my eyes among the holy saints of the Church of the Firstborn and breathed the heavenly atmosphere of brotherly love. The Spirit of the Almighty gave me understanding of the Scriptures. The spirit of brotherhood gave me social security, and the spirit of obedience gave me the glorious liberty of the sons of God. I came here as a stranger, and the saints took me in. I was hungry, and they gave me meat. I was sick, and they administered to me. I was poor, and distribution was made for my relief. Anything a mother could do for her own child, the church has for me. Brother and Sister Stevens, the parents of my second birth, provided for my welfare. When he found out I had a little money left over from my father's estate in the hands of trustees, which I was unable to get, Brother Stevens hired a lawyer and secured it at once. He also helped me get a social security number that I might get an income for life." Among Moses' papers at the LDS History Library are several autobiographies he wrote. one of which was rendered as a poem. There are also artworks and poetry. Some of them might be confusing if you don't understand his beliefs. This illustration accompanies one of his poems, and he describes the creation of the earth as a great surrounding wall enclosing heaven, life, and all. He adds, "To light the inside of this sphere is a revolving chandelier whereon the great and lesser light are set to give us day and night." I don't know that the LDS Church has an official policy on whether the earth is convex or concave. I don't think our salvation depends on which earth model we place our faith in. Mormons believe the Bible, as did the Christians. In the Bible, Moses continued to find support for his beliefs. As a Mormon convert from Christianity, he was probably intrigued by two illustrations from the Book of Abraham. Facsimile 1 shows Abraham about to be sacrificed on an altar. Beneath the altar is what may be interpreted as five layers of strata, labeled figure 12, in which we are informed that they are the firmament over our heads. The heavens. T taught that the earth's surface has five geologic strata, underlain by five mineral strata. Below these layers is figure 11, the pillars of heaven as understood by the Egyptians. It's confusing to us, but it made perfect sense to Brother Weaver. He never mentioned this, but you know, this is an obvious thing that he might have noticed. Additional support can be found in facsimile number 2 of the Book of Abraham, which is filled with interesting things. Figure 5 in yellow indicates that the sun borrows its light from Kolob, which is shown in green, light green. shown in green. Moses would have had no problem reconciling this with Teed cellular cosmogony, as what we see is the sun is actually an optical device, according to Teed, and the source of its light is invisible to us. Maybe it's Kolob. He may have found confirmation for his Koreshian beliefs in other Mormon scriptures as well, especially in Helaman 12:15, which I'm not going to read to you, D&C 88:13, and D&C 121:28-30. He would have found inspiration in this verse, D&C 93:30. All truth is independent of that in that sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself, as all intelligence also, otherwise there is no existence. In 1952, Moses went to the temple for his endowment, and later he was sealed to his brothers, his father, and his mother. He had been a widower for 22 years before he joined the LDS Church. He wrote, "Having considered virgin purity superior to marriage, you can imagine my surprise when a high priest advised me to find a widow, one who was not sealed to her husband, and marry her for time and eternity. At first, I thought it was a joke. When the eternal marriage covenant was explained to me, I could see that one could never be too old for that." 2 years later, he met a widow of that description, Maria F. Sandbeck, who had joined the church in 1950 after immigrating from Germany with her son Gustav. They married in the temple in 1954 when he was 91 and she was 61, but her heart had never recovered from terrifying experiences she had experienced during the war. And she went directly from the temple to the hospital, where she died 23 days later. He later had his two previous wives, Ada and Tacy Evelyn, sealed to him. When Moses died in December 1965, at the age of 102, he was the oldest man in Utah. That same year, NASA launched the first five manned Gemini spacecraft into low Earth orbit. If you'd like to know more about this interesting group, I've placed the links to the most important online resources at the following website, koreshian.homestead.com, and thank you for coming. And I guess, what now? Anybody got a question?
Thank you. For those who came in late, we have a recording device that's requires you to speak in a really strong voice. We have about 5 minutes for questions.
Yeah?
I have a question. How long did you say the heyday was in Florida with the unity? About what years, you know, what time span is that?
Well, the interesting thing I found is that, that when he had the Divine Motherhood appear to him, she told him that she'd be with him for three weeks of years. And if that's 21 years, that's exactly the number of years from 1897 until 1908 when he died. Mm-hmm. That's just interesting.
And that was the initial vision that he had?
Yeah. The initial vision was in 1870, but the corrections actually didn't get going until about 1887. Yeah?
What got you interested in this to begin with?
I didn't even know anything about it, you know, but when I went on my mission to Fort Myers, Florida, and we were driving past the site once, and I was just reading a tourist pamphlet, and it told about these corrections, and they believe that the earth is hollow, and they said that the stars that you see at night, this was, you know, people didn't know a lot about them back then, and so that this leaflet said that the stars that you see at night are the campfires of, and lights of the cities on the other side of the world. I thought that was kind of odd. And then I also found it was interesting that it said that Koresh's tomb had been carried away by a hurricane. And I, you know, I mean, that just sort of, you know, leaves it open-ended. Yeah?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on LDS belief in the hollow earth theory? I've heard that when I was at college and
one of the assistants to the mission president, when I was on my mission, he fasted and prayed about it, and he found out that the 10 tribes are in the hollow earth, and they're going to come out, you know, when the time happens. You know, with Google Earth, it's easier to look at the end of the earth and see if there's a hole there or not. but this was a very popular idea among Mormons. Back about 1900, is, you know, because actually, you know, religions sort of borrow ideas from each other, and Hollow Earth is actually, if you try it on the internet, you'll find there's people that say flying saucers are parked there. They say all kinds of things. In fact, you know, you know, it's very popular. In fact, this Hollow Earth idea that Dr. Teed has, some of these references, the bottom line is modern ideas about Hollow Earth. It turns out that there's still people that believe it's possible, you know, but you have to figure out a way of proving it. And the only people that have tried to prove it is the Koreshans. And they were successful in proving their idea. Yeah?
It seems like a lot of the 19th century utopian groups had their own particular diets. And maybe you mentioned this in the beginning of the presentation, I missed it. Did the Koreshans have a particular diet that they followed?
They all ate in the same cafeteria, and, you know, I mean, it was very well organized. They had, you know, they'd rotate through and get, you know, they'd be servants and stuff. The foods that they brought into the colony were, you know, they were bringing in plants that were from tropical places like Africa, and so they actually had a lot of foods. I don't know about them or forbidding things, except that actually they weren't allowed to drink, smoke, or, you know, if you wanted to hear the longer version of it, you'd be here for another half hour. they weren't allowed to drink, you know, smoke or drink, but Koresh said that you have to take humanity as they come, and, you know, that eventually they learned to stop doing it. So they were kind of like Mormons in that respect, except that they allowed you to join even though you're still smoking or drinking. Yeah?
Say more about the video clip. The beginning. How did that come about?
Well, there was a newsreel that was made. If you go to there's the unofficial website, you can actually watch it again. But there was a newsreel that was done by Movietone News, and they had filmed this, but they never actually put it in their on their newsreel. So, you know, audiences never saw it. It just sort of showed up among films.
What year was that dated to?
The film itself was 1933. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Stephen, for a very well presented, well organized thing. That's the end of our session.